Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
And you can't see this, but Gabe, you and I, we have a new setup here. We're looking at each other from different sides of the table than ever before, so.
Same room, you're sitting in a different desk. That's huge.
That's a big change. We're going to start with an email here, and the email goes like this. Was wondering if you would consider, you being Gabe and me, doing a three-week experiment where both hosts read the research being discussed, including the scientist being interviewed. Their personalities would ensure the spontaneous give-and-take nature of the present format, but would assist in the level of discussion. Couple of things to say on that there. We are of two minds on this one, and hence we do it, we do it two ways. Sometimes we do it that way, where we've both read the study in advance.
Yeah.
And other times I like that one of us is the quote unquote underinformed or less informed, because only that one of us is going to have the same questions as the listener, if that makes sense.
This is a question for people listening to this podcast. Should we both be completely informed and ready with our intelligent questions so that the level of discussion is higher? Or do you like that one of us is quote unquote naive and comes at it from the perspective of the listener, who is not...
I mean, we've read... We know the nuts and bolts.
That was why I said quote-unquote.
Yeah. No, the reason I say that he's not necessarily wrong is that I think there are benefits and consequences to both systems, which is why we do both. If you... we've had situations where we've been fully informed, almost over-informed, with regard to the paper and others like it. Then we interview the expert and then we finish it up and we think, this is not really an interview that is interesting for like normal people. It's really, really in-depth, detail-oriented. And I think switching it up and sometimes having one of us be less informed than the other ensures that we'll have basic questions of understanding that will help all of you to understand. So I appreciate the request. We've done both. Probably stick into the mixed mode that we keep doing. If anyone, like Abe said, though, if you disagree, if you think we should always both know everything all the time,
weigh in on this. We'd love to hear your guys' perspective, because then that's what shapes this show. What you guys want?
Yeah, right? We don't really care about all that much else. Than really, I'm serious. Like, anyway, Gabe, you have some science.
Yeah, this one's about dogs, one specific kind of dog, Labradors. And why they are so hungry. Labs tend to be obese. My idea of a lab is kind of chubby.
I had a brown lab, a chocolate lab. Her name was Hershey.
Was Hershey chubby?
A little bit. Not overweight, but not definitely not the skin and bones of some of the thinner dogs out there, like the greyhounds and the whippets.
A high proportion of labs are obese, and it has to do with a particular gene variant. And that's what this study was looking into. This is Cambridge. They were looking at 87 Labradors. And of these Labradors, some of them had this gene variant, and others didn't. What they did in the first part of the experiment to compare all the dogs involved was just let them eat as much as they want. Every 20 minutes, they had a full can of beautiful dog food, and they could just go at it until they, you know, that feeling of satiety came in.
Yeah.
And all the dogs, regardless of whether they had this gene variant or not, ate the same amount. They just...
Oh, interesting. That had no effect. Okay.
So from that perspective, they were normal.
And if
the ones with this gene variant in part two of the experiment were subjected to normal feeding a situation where they were given their normal amount of food. And then after that, they put a sausage in a clear, transparent box in the room and measured the time that these dogs sniffed and tried to get this box open. They could see it.
The untouchable
they could smell
sausage.
It. They knew there was a sausage in there, but they couldn't eat it. And the dogs with this gene variant went at it for hours, way, way longer than the other labs. And then they measured, after the dogs went to sleep, they measured how many calories were burned. And the dogs with this gene variation burned 25% less calories. So this means they have, according to their bodies, they're hungrier. And they don't burn as much food. So because of this genetic variation, this mutation... They are hungrier and preserve the food more.
or at the very least more persistent in getting at that food. Obviously dog breeds are going to be different on that one, but they can be extremely persistent. And the fact that one group is so different basically won't stop until they get the food is...
And this mutation happens in human beings as well. It's extremely rare. It's an extremely rare genetic disease. Hasn't really been studied. Isn't known exactly what the mechanism is. But those people also suffer from severe obesity. So if research on this mutation is continued, it could have effects both for dogs and for humans. So
that would be great, yeah. This is very unrelated. Saw a post the other day from a woman who is saying that every day she goes on a walk a couple times with her dogs, and there's a spot that the dog always runs over and takes a look at, and probably always will, and that's because one day, years ago, somebody had tossed a hamburger there. And now every single day, probably for the rest of its existence,
just maybe,
it goes to hamburger spot.
Maybe.
Maybe this is the day where another hamburger is right there, right where I remember it.
The only reason I did the dog one, I almost lost my dog over the weekend. Beavis got hit by a car.
I don't know anything about this.
Yeah.
What?
There was a poodle on the other side of a street. We got a street that runs right by our house. We've talked about it before with regard to noise.
And cars.
The decibel level around our house is extreme because of the cars that fly by. Or drive by, I guess, as it were. And so he sees this poodle and runs out. For a second, we didn't have the gate closed.
I was just going
to
say,
because Heidi had run away. She always runs away to our neighbor. Without telling us, she goes to Frau Gertz's place or Mrs. Gertz's place without telling us, so we didn't know where Heidi was, and that's why we left the gate open. And in that second, there's a poodle on the other side of the street. He darts across the street and gets hit by a Mercedes. And he's alive. No eternal bleeding.
How? Because you have... the speed limit's 30 or 50 kilometers an hour on your street.
This guy was 80 years old.
Oh,
he was an
80-year-old
German driving a silver Mercedes. You know how those guys are.
Slow, yet cautious, careful.
He himself got out of the car. He was shaking. He thought he had killed the dog. The dog, at that point, was on the ground shaking, but survived.
Right? Go Beavis.
Yeah.
You probably went to the vet, and the vet cleared everything up.
We got the green light, yeah.
Go Beavis.
Mm-hmm.
Will that dog learn from that experience?
No.
Probably not.
No.
Will it learn that when last time I ran across this road, I was struck by...
Will it learn next time I see a poodle, I'm going to chase after it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to chase that poodle.
It was worth it because I'm still alive. So some more research for you. Different topic now. Gabe, when I came in this morning, do you remember the first thing I did?
No.
This was like a couple...
Is this today?
A couple hours ago. What did I do? Do you remember?
You had jogged in.
Yeah.
You opened the door?
Well, yeah, okay. And then I came in, and I did what? There was something I was going to talk to you. I talked to you about first, and I was like, "You're looking at me so blankly." I was like, "I'm sorry. I got it.
Wait a
minute.
Your health insurance. Something with your health insurance.
Yeah. And I will not go into the outrageously minute details.
You were frustrated about something. There was some paperwork you had to fill out. Some bureaucracy. Some German.
I would go beyond
Uber German bureaucracy. Yeah,
I'd go beyond frustration. Say it was actual anger. I was angry.
Yeah.
So what I did is I vented to you about it.
Oh, that.
I vented. Yeah, I vented about this.
In one year out the other.
Okay. So my question for you, and it's directly connected to the answers in the research here. I did that. You listened.
Mm-hmm.
On a sliding scale, did my anger go up, remain neutral, go down? What did it do?
You weren't that mad when it started, and you hadn't calmed down by the end of it either, I didn't think.
So venting did not help?
I don't think so.
You're exactly right. According to actually lots of research, it doesn't help. Dumping all of that on you this morning didn't help me. There's no research.
It made me kind of angry, to be completely honest.
Yeah, exactly. And this is called the catharsis theory. The catharsis theory would be the idea that should help me because I'm getting it all out. That's not true. The other thing, and that's why I kind of had to talk about this today, you mentioned I jogged in. I do. I've had another tactic, and I hold it dear to my chest that when I'm angry, I can go exercise. And my form of exercise, my favorite, is jogging. And that does not help. In fact, it not only does it not help, it can make your anger worse. So to deal with it, I think a lot of people think about how to deal with the anger in terms of your mind, right? This is cognitive behavioral therapy. There are different things you could do, but the physiological side, I think, kind of gets ignored, certainly by me. I thought jogging was a good thing. Jogging raises your physiological arousal. This happened to me 2 weeks ago, where I was angry, went for a jog, ended up going for a much further jog than I wanted to because the anger wasn't out. Not only was it not out, it was stronger. And now I have kind of like a tendon that's inflamed because I went way too far, but whatever. Anyway, it does not help. So how do you reduce physiological arousal so that even if you have not dealt with the thoughts at all, right, they're still the same, just reduce it. What actually works? So in these 150 studies, obviously they looked at a lot of different things, but primarily physical activities, jogging, cycling, swimming, boxing, but then also calming tactics, calming activities. So these were things like deep breathing, mindfulness, meditation, yoga. Long story short, those latter ones work.
Paying attention to in
and out. You are almost hacking your body to decrease physiological arousal, and that is going to have a direct impact on how those negative emotions spill out or whether they spill out of your body, because again, venting isn't necessarily as effective as we think.
It is not easy to do, though, or easier said than done, to just concentrate on your breathing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It takes a lot of training, a lot of discipline.
Right. And it's not something...
Start out small. Do it for 1 minute. Do it for 10 seconds. And then with each day, incrementally increase the amount of time that you concentrate on your breathing, because it's hard to not be distracted by other stuff or start thinking about those things that are making you angry or frustrated or whatever. And just concentrate on your breathing.
Right? I thought that was really practical advice. And some of you out there probably already do mindfulness, meditation, yoga. Recently, I was reading a book that reminded me of if you can visualize a rectangle, and if you go up the short side of the rectangle, that's you breathing in. Then you go across the high side, breathing out.
Cool. And make it all around.
Yeah, and you go around that rectangle. It really works for me. The other thing I liked, and I'm not sure, it obviously wouldn't have been in every single study, but some of the studies appeared to show there's a difference between which kind of sports you're doing. And the critical difference is, are you doing it for fun with other people? Then that's going to reduce physiological arousal.
Hmm.
If it's they looked at kids who were doing physical education in the United States or sport classes at their schools. They also looked at team sporting events, games that were for fun, obviously, recreational. Those tended to work better, not completely decrease arousal levels, but they decreased it rather than increased it. That's another opportunity for you to deal with anger.
So now, on the one hand, focus on your breathing, do these calming techniques, and on the other hand, seek out other people and play games with them, sports with them?
Yeah. I like this advice because it's free or mostly free. You can do it yourself. The lead author, Sophie Kjervik, I think she's originally from Norway, did this research at Ohio State. She also noted kind of or said like, look, we know cognitive behavioral therapy, it's expensive, costs money. There are also apps and YouTube videos out there. Which ones she was thinking about or referencing, I don't know. I don't feel in a position to give any sort of recommendation there. But yeah, I think in a world where I think anecdotally people tend to say that other people feel angrier, this kind of research is really important.
All right. Well, that's it from us, I guess, at this point. Let's say goodbye.
Call it a wrap?
Yeah. Or no, ask people to get in touch via email. SU@DW.com, that works.
Yeah, well, and before we limit it to that, we should mention again our YouTube channel, DW Podcasts. We have videos regularly coming out there. You can see us. I was going to say we wave to you. I think, yeah, we wave to you sometimes on there, but you can always leave a comment on YouTube. For a lot of people, that's faster, easier. They're familiar with that app. However you want to get in touch with us, just do it.